promises of truth thou hast for me. Open mine eyes, illumine me. Spirit divine, love of my life.
Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld. And this program is a series of ongoing investigations into the nature of reality and also a planetary transformation that's happening around the world. And part of that is how can we start to think different about reality and what we know of ourselves. And tonight's guest is someone who's, I feel, investigated that field about different ways of knowing, different ways of experiencing our life in the world. His name is Arnold Mandel. He's the author of 19 books published in 20 languages, particularly on the dream body and process work. He has a Jungian background, and I'm happy you're here, Arnie. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, Alan, and thank you for exploring new realities. We need more of them.
Well, exactly. And I your work is so vast that we should start right there. Like, how do you define reality based on what you call the dream body and the process work? And go a little bit into the background behind those, if you don't mind.
How do I define reality? Well, let me say something about my background so you'll understand me better. I studied at MIT. I was originally a scientist. I was practicing physics, applied physics, engineering, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that physics wasn't sufficiently scientific in the sense that it takes observations and it looks at them and it says, I can see this or I can see that, or there's a probability of this or that happening, but they don't sufficiently study the observer, me and you. That's the first person experience. So you may look at me or I look at you, I see a person, I measure up, you have a certain weight, you know, all those kinds of things. But then there's all sorts of other feelings and things and dreams that you're having that are not treated sufficiently scientifically. So I started to study Jungian psychology.
Well,
yes?
I just wanted to ask you about that because science, and that's been the big divide in science, is science is only really Western science, what you can measure and observe. It doesn't really take into account any feeling, any internal, any subjective experience. I mean,
It doesn't know what to do with non-repeatable experience. It says it admits that that's possible. But for example, if you go to your doctor or I go to my doctor, a normal medical doctor, and say, I have a stomach ache, he'll take some chemical measurements. He'll take some different physical measurements, but asking about how I experience my stomach ache, that's a first-person experience. Science doesn't treat first-person experiences sufficiently scientifically. They don't analyze, they don't look at them, they don't follow those experiences.
Mm. And so you and your experience knew that there was another level of reality that was based on the subjective.
Exactly. So I mean, from my Jungian, I went into the Jungian psychology, and I love Jungian psychology. I love Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And his treating of the dreams and dreaming so seriously as he does and taking that seriously. And then one day in my early 30s, I had some pain in my feet, and my God, it was the gout at the age of 30. So my doctors thought at the time. And I realized, my God, they're treating me allopathically. What happened to the meaningfulness of Jungian psychology? There was no dreaming body. There was just a body. And I was being treated as a body as if it wasn't mine.
Yeah, so, but that's such a major point in Western medicine that we're still trying to deal with. they treat the body as if it's uninhabitable, and life itself is an accident, and there's no connection to any source of creation, you know?
So, I do know, yes.
Yeah, right, so you knew there was something wrong with that. Sure.
So when I said, the doctor said, I have the gout, I said, no, I have a pain in my foot that feels like hell. And he said, I don't know what to do with that. So they're doing their best. Part of reality is the physical reality. I call it consensus reality, Alan. Mm-hmm. Consensus means the consent that reality is my physical body. Is a physical thing that can be treated physically. And I do love that. I believe in that. Being a physicist especially, I take that seriously.
Mm.
However, it didn't make me feel better, and I needed to go more deeply into what is reality and incorporate not just consensus reality, but also the whole world of dreams, dreaming, and so-called non-consensus or subjective reality, first-person experience.
So the first person experience was sort of your jumping off point into kind of an original thinking, into kind of a creative exploration about the nature of who we are.
That's right. Yeah. So that's right. Following the person, the way she is. Mm-hmm. From Jung, I learned to follow dreams. Then I wanted to learn to follow the dreaming as it's happening in our body, a moment to moment. For example, I'm talking to you now, but I'm standing up here on the west coast overlooking the sea, and what you can't see is I'm very excited because I'm inspired by the conversation. So now I'm saying it, but that would be a dreaming. These things that are not, you don't hear them automatically in my vocabulary.
Wait, but let me see if I understand that. So the dreaming would be the experience of the feel of the emotion of the internal perception.
Dreaming is internal, and believe it or not, Alan, dreaming is visible. If we develop our eyes, you can see it in my signals. I'm dancing around a little bit here, and I'm moving around, and you can see it in people's signals. Mm. For example, shall I give you another example
of
that?
Yes, please, because I also want to add another piece of your work to that. But go, please give me another example. Yes.
Sure. So think, for example, of one of my early clients when I was working in Switzerland. It was a pastor, a reverend, a very sweet man, who came in and said he was having stabbing heart pains.
Mm-hmm.
So he smiled at me while he said that, but I did notice that he had his nails, he was putting his nails into his skin as he was talking. I said, how do you experience your nails? He said, they're sharp. I said, isn't that interesting? That sharpness is not just in your heart pain, in angina, it's also in your nails, what you're doing right now. I can see it. I said, have you any recently had any dreams of anything? And he said, yes, I dreamed that after I found out I have a very bad heart, I dreamed about a big knife.
Mm.
Why did I dream that? So I said, I can see the knife in the way you use your nails right now, and I can hear you trying to be definitive. And I said, maybe you need to be a little sharper and more definitive in the way you do things. And he started roaring with laughter. He said, oh my God, my congregation has been telling me that for a long time, that I'm too nice, I'm not sharp and definitive enough. So
the dream of his own internal dream and his own body itself was telling him something.
Yes.
His own psychology.
That's right. His double signals, that means not the signals he associates with, but his nails into his skin, and his experience of the heart, namely sharpness, were just like his dream of a knife. So I call this experience of the body the dream body, that our dream body is there. And to make him feel better, I said, you should begin to use that knife, not just on yourself, but use it outside, be more definitive.
Mm.
And lo and behold, his heart pains got better.
Wow.
So there, I tell you, that's a very simple story about how integrating dreaming, which you can't see, so-called subjective experience, but really it's not subjective. You can see it in people's signals.
Well, another aspect of it not being subjective, and I think I read it somewhere in one of your books, is that the external environment, like a sound in the street, Jung had that happen to him as well, is a kind of interaction with our deep psyche. Can you tell me one of those stories where a group was going on and there was something happening external in the world that reflected the process of the people in the group?
Well, that's very interesting, because I remember one of my first Amy and I work on conflict resolution also in different parts of the world. So let me just be more methodical. So this dream body idea went further, and you could see the dreaming happening in relationships and in large groups. You can see it happening in people near death. You can see, and it's a useful thing in working with people in extreme or psychotic conditions. But
can you just say, how would you work with it in an extreme and psychotic condition? I'm interested in that as well.
Well, I follow the person. I don't just assume that a so-called psychotic person is crazy. The word psychotic, the medical diagnosis, I totally understand, and I understand the importance of giving medicine and making people feel better and calmer. If it works, all the better. On the other hand, I learned to work with people when there was no pills yet in Switzerland. There were none of them. The medicines were still very undeveloped. So, for example, one of the people I met for the first time, her psychiatrist invited me into the mental hospital where she was, and this particular person, he said, "She's completely crazy. Just look at her. What shall we do?" And I looked at her. She was under her bed. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. She's under the bed. She won't come out. Mm. Now, that's a real opportunity for an adult therapist. How many times do I've never had a chance really to work with anybody who's under a bed.
That's funny.
She's really creative. So in any case, to make the story short, I also got under a chair and I just was there with her, following her process. And after a minute or two, she said, "Blub." And I said, "Blub." And to make the story short, we were blubbing together, and she said she was a fish. Mm-hmm. And then some weeks later, to make that story short, she was out of the mental hospital and in my practice. And she explained to me that she didn't like being a human being, Alan, because being a human being for her meant that she had to be part of her family system. That was during, just after the Second World War. Her father had done some very ugly things in the country that she was from to other people. And she just, when she learned about it, she went so-called crazy. But she wasn't. Craziness is basically a subjective experience which isn't being followed enough. That's my point.
So you followed her into her
Into her fish.
Into her mythologies, into her own mind, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I assume that process knows the way. I follow process. That's why I call the work that we do process-oriented psychology. I look at somebody's process, whether it's his nails into his skin or a pain that he has or whatever. I follow the dreaming process without first diagnosing the person or interpreting them as sane or insane.
Oh, so that's right. I got that from your books. It's like you're just following along as the universe is giving you signals. And you're saying, what's this about? You have this open, inquisitive mind that says, okay, what's the world trying to show me?
Yes, I'm like, in some ways, process work is like Taoism.
Yeah.
I say there's a Tao. That means there's a situation. Now, it's a kind of spiritual thing for me. I behave mostly like a practical therapist, but it's a spiritual thing. The universe is showing me something. I want to open up and see if I can follow it. In reality, take a pill if you don't feel good. If it doesn't work, go deeper, follow your dreaming, and go even deeper, even if that's not enough.
Well, that's been your amazing work with people in comas. I mean, you don't actually, I mean, you've been able, I've heard, bring people out of comas by following the process of their dream, of their breathing and things. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely right. Should I tell you something about that?
Yeah, tell me about something and then we'll get back to the collective thing. But this is all really fascinating and I'm truly trying, I'm getting what you're about and it would be, it's a great way to just live moment to moment as well, isn't it?
It is. It's more fun. It's more creative to live this way. You never know. You set your life up and make all sorts of dates and then you see what happens. Right. Well, yes, in coma, I discussed that in my book on coma, and Amy, my wife, has also written on coma. There I discuss, for example, the case of somebody who was dying, and he was already comatose, and the doctor said, well, he's done. You might as well just say goodbye, and that's it. But his wife wanted Amy and me to work with him. Amy's my wife, to work with this man. So we sat by his bedside and I said, no, just follow your breathing. He's not talking, obviously. He's lying there. So I'm just following the process, breathing with him, breathing in, breathing out, watching the tiny little flickerings of his eyes, assuming he might be experiencing something. So I say, notice that. Oh, we noticed your eyes flickering. We noticed this. We noticed that. And to make the story short.
But you said that out loud.
Out loud.
I see.
While he's breathing, we're talking to him, assuming there is somebody there, even though nobody thinks he's there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we assume he's dreaming. And after a couple of hours, he sat up in bed. And he started talking to us, and I won't go through the whole dialogue. He came back for 24 hours to resolve and complete a whole bunch of things that he wanted to complete, to say, to tell his love to everybody and what have you. You can read about that in one of my books.
Right.
And then he was ready, and then he said, well, Arnie, thanks a lot. I'm going to go on studying with you afterwards, but for now, that's it. And then he died.
Wow. And
he's a terrific guy.
It must have been an awakening for you in some ways to know the power of this work. Or were you like expecting, which is like, oh, no big deal. Or were you really saying, oh, my God, look what we can communicate with?
Alan, that's a really good question. I have constantly been surprised by the power of nature.
Mm.
Consensus reality says the man is in a coma now. That was in the mid-1980s. Now today people are beginning to pick up our work around the world and communicate with people in comas, and many can come out and talk about their experiences and live on. But I have constantly been absolutely amazed. My God, life is much more than I ever realized it could be.
Wow. And you're still, I mean, I get that excitement just in your voice and just by hearing your enthusiasm for your work. I mean, it's an ongoing.
An ongoing discovery.
Each moment, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
You never know what's going to happen.
That if you could communicate that to the world, then that, I mean, and you are, but it's a gift that each one of us has that potentially evolving dream body to discover.
Each of us has a remarkable intelligence that we're not quite in touch with. Mm. It's the intelligence that Jung saw behind the dreams. People have called it God and the mind of God and all that kind of thing. That intelligence is right there. For example, you even see it in group work.
Yeah.
Can I switch and talk?
Work. Yes. Because...
Group work, yeah. For example, Amy and I work with a group that was having a big problem because the vice – and this is a good example for today, especially with all the economic problems. In any case, in this group, the vice president of the organization had stolen a lot of money. So they kicked the vice president out, but everybody was talking about the vice president anyhow. In fact, they were talking about the vice president so much that people weren't going to work. They were just talking about the vice president. So they invited us in to help. So now there's a group situation and the vice president isn't there, but the vice president is there.
Right.
In another sense,
right.
Things that people talk about in groups and in relationships that cannot be directly represented, like the vice president, he's gone,
mm-hmm.
are still there. And we call them ghost roles. And we get the group then to play that ghost role out, play out the vice president. We said to everybody, and we got together with this large group, and everyone said, I want to steal this. I want to steal that. I'm going to steal this, this, that. And I said, now really feel that. What are you saying? They said, I want to steal something. And then suddenly a woman said, I too want to steal something. And the reason is because no one appreciates me. No one says good morning when they come in the office. I just sit here at the desk and nobody says hello. I want a flower. I want to steal something. I would like more love here. And suddenly everybody started saying the same thing. Yeah, we want to be appreciated too. And so in other words, the vice president who had stolen was a symbol of everybody's need in the organization to get more appreciation for who they are. And that was the end of the stealing, and that was in the organization. That was the beginning of the making a lot more money. They were happier.
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of some of my friends are divorced, and even in the separation, I was talking to this one woman, the separation and the argument is what binds the relationship together still.
Sure.
So, I mean, how does one get through that in your work and finally get disconnected from the thing that wants to occupy the psyche, you know?
By going into it more deeply. Like, for example, between conflicting parties, like in Ireland some years ago when the Irish were in terrible straits, we were working in Dublin, and then people were saying, you're the bad, I'm going to make it really simple, you're the bad guy. No, you are the evil people. You've done this. And the other said, then you've done that. No, you killed my people. The other said, you killed my people. So then Amy and I basically said, so death is in the air.
Mm.
How is death? So I'm going deeper than the killer. I'm talking about the essence of the ghost role. How, not just who's the killer, but is death in the air? And my God, that was so amazing. I saw that suddenly. What is that big red spot I see on the side of your neck? I said to one of the main political participants. And he said, the doctor told me not to come today because he said I could die. I have lethally high blood pressure. Then somebody from the other side said, I was told not to come because I just had a heart attack. Death is in the air. And they looked at each other, Alan, these two men from opposing parties who were afraid and who hated each other, then said, you're going to die? And the other one said, you're going to die? And in front of these hundreds of people gathered together there in downtown Dublin, suddenly these two guys embraced each other, realizing they were both on the verge of death.
Mm.
And the whole group came together. There was an understanding that was just before a voting on the peace accord there in Ireland. So the way to do things is to say, what is the bad thing happening between us and what's the essence of it? It's a little different all the time.
But what does this all say about human beings and our kind of internal landscape and how we are in a way supposed to be in the world? What is the right way of being from your experience, and how can we bring the most joy to our experience because of this kind of interactive, co-creative energy we can have with the universe?
Your question, if I understand, is how should we be living to live most joyously? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, based on all the people you've worked with and this understanding of the process, how can we use all these experiences, yes, to have the most fun, to be in the most correct relationship with with this force that's working with us. Yes.
My suggestion to those who are able, some people say, I don't want to know more about myself. I just want to live my life and that's it. And I say, fine, if you're happy that way, do that. But for other, and probably the majority of the human race, the happiest way to live is to believe in yourself. Believe in all of your experiences. Don't marginalize tiny little things. Take them as potentially significant. Get to the essence of them. What could they be meaning for you? Try playing with them. And the same in relationships and in organizations. Take yourself seriously, all that you experience. That's my suggestion.
So, I mean, but some people also say meaning is not absolute. Meaning is what we create. I mean, is there an absolute meaning that the body sometimes wants to tell us, or is there, you know, is it just what we project onto meaning?
That's a really big question. Meaning is definitely not absolute, nor is it permanent. There's more sustainable, more permanent experiences we have. There's the Tao that can be said, that's always changing, but there's something about each human being which is the deepest part of us. I call that the process mind. The deepest part of us doesn't change too much, and we usually project it. It can easily be projected or experienced as a piece of the earth. Who we are is a piece of the earth or a piece of the universe. And we just look like human beings most of the time. But when we go to sleep at night and when we're very attentive to our subtle things, we pick up all sorts of little tiny tips about what to do next. These things are coming from our deepest part of the process mind, but you need to be pretty aware to pick that stuff up.
Well, it also has to do with creativity. I'm here in Connecticut with two very creative people, and we've been discussing this idea of letting the universe itself work through us as sort of agents of feeling, you know?
Definitely. Yes, I mean, an artist, for example, to live like an artist means that everything is art. So if I were to identify myself as being an artist, and I do sometimes, and my wife Amy Shirley does, then the idea is you put the piece of paper in front of you, or you look at a piece of clay, and you watch how it informs you, it dialogues with you, so to speak, about what to do next. Great art and very creative people do this all the time.
So the
picking up flirts, we call them.
But then it's like related to the process work, because it's like, let's see what wants to happen, and then we're dialoguing with that creative force, is what you're saying, right?
That's right. For example, somebody comes to see me and says they're very, very depressed. They can't move. They don't know what to do next. And they never have any dreams, and they have no experiences, and they don't want to follow their body. So then I say, that all sounds perfect to me. So let's just notice what happens next. Well, nothing's happening next, the person says. Then I say, that's good. I'll wait. Suddenly he said, how come you don't pull your shades down more? I said, why? He said, there's the sun is out there. I said, the sun is catching your attention? He said, you bet, that's bright, that sun. And I said, that's interesting, that bright sun is so beautiful. He said, yeah. He said, actually, I'm always so dark and somber. Why am I not more like that sunshine? So there it is, that he picked up a piece of the environment that was flirting with him, so to speak, the sun. So you can work with the moment, whatever is happening, that the moment has everything in it.
And you were also going to say before we got sidetracked about this causality that also happens in the moment with our minds and our like how things outside in the street, even though they will catch our attention for us. Do you know what I mean? You know,
yeah, I can only agree with you. That's right.
But tell me a story. Yeah, tell me an example of that, because I want to explain that to other people, but I think you've seen this in process.
You mean synchronicities that happen suddenly?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, this is something that Jung and Pauli were very interested in. You're walking down the street, and certain kinds of colors or a certain kind of person catches your attention. And if you then are able to follow your dreams, almost always the things that catch your attention you can find in your dreams. It's like dreaming while awake. It's like lucid dreaming.
But there's a specific instances where you were working with groups where you can talk about that. I think I read that in one of your books somewhere.
Yes. Oh, I see. Yes, in a group. Like, for example.
Yes.
I can't say the countries that we were working in this case, but there was two groups from two different countries which are at war with one another. And the people were there and everybody's being very nice, trying to be very nice to one another. And each group is saying, we try to do the best we can. And the others are, we're trying to do the best we can. And suddenly there was a big thunder outside, like from the skies, a big boom coming in, and everyone was shocked. And then I said, would everyone be kind enough please to also be the thunder for a couple of seconds? And everyone picked up the thunder by saying brr. Then I said, now let's continue our conversation with more in it. And wow, the issues came up in seconds. Well, I really hate you, and I really hate you, and what's behind the hatred? You hurt us, and all sorts of feeling things could come up, and we could get down to business and get through it. And I understand, you see, groups at war don't want to have to face each other and talk about it. It's easier to shoot one another than it is to be thunderous and to work through the feeling stuff. So that's an example of how the environment was a great help.
But how are we ever going to put an end to war? People have to start to look at their feelings somehow. I mean, how do you see this changing in the worldwide culture that, you know, you're so involved with?
We are. I used to think people are just mixed up. They need to develop more or do this. I don't think that anymore. I think most people are fine the way they are. I don't want to change anything about the human race. I love people the way they are. However, we need more facilitators, Alan. We need more people who can model loving all sides, model understanding all sides, who don't get polarized themselves. It's not the general mass of people that's all messed up. It's we don't have enough leaders and enough facilitators. The best facilitators you find in ashrams, or you find having mystical New Age experiences, but we need those people right there on the streets in the middle of conflict helping. That's the next step, I hope.
So that's been your work lately. So you went from Jungian, you went from physics to Jungian to this creative dreaming process work to conflict. Is that the sort of journey you've been on? And now,
yes, I've been on the journey of trying to understand, like you and like others and like many of us, who are we? Why are we here? What are we supposed to be doing? How can we be close to the universe and let it speak through us? The universe obviously has a huge diversity capacity. It's got room for everybody. The planet Earth has room for everybody. How can we find more people, more facilitators, who also have a big heart to have more room for everybody? That has been a constant driving force in my life since I was a child.
So, but also back to your personal search, you've gotten answers. You've understood in a sense who you are and where we're going and what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, the universe spoke to you because you've listened, it sounds like.
Yes, I wouldn't say that I've always listened. It spoke, even when I wasn't ready to listen. And it awakened me many times. I wouldn't call myself, I try to be as open-minded as possible and listen carefully to things. But the universe speaks even when we're not listening, and those are important things. And each has her own path or his own path getting there.
Tell me a situation where you felt like the universe was speaking that you weren't listening to.
Universe, there was that example when many years ago when I had a case of the gout. I had already had all sorts of dreams about needing to make changes in psychology and carrying out new things, but I really wasn't able to do it. I was afraid to do it and what have you. And then, woof, the universe spoke to me through the pain in my foot and said, stop walking the way you are. Start a new way of walking. So big symptoms are wonderful tips often that can give us hints about things that we're afraid to think or new ways of being that we're shy about. The body is a terrific message bringer from the universe for me.
A reflection of our own pure consciousness in a way, isn't it, the body?
It is. It is.
So, but I'm also interested now in this work you're doing back to physics, back to quantum physics, and how that is pulling together all these other pieces that you've been investigating. How do you, resolve it all?
Well, yes, that my most recent book, The Process Mind, is an attempt to resolve these things. That as a physicist, I always loved looking into the universe. What are the laws that govern this universe? Are there laws? And if so, how is it that we can understand them? And what is Einstein called the laws of nature, the mind of God? So, as you know, or as you may know, physics in the last years, last probably good 50, 60 years, has been looking for the unified field theory, something that pulls all of physics together. And because there are various forces in physics like gravity and the electromagnetic force and strong and weak nuclear forces and what have you, and there's no TOE theory of everything.
Right.
They're looking for that. But psychology too has had the same problem. There's no theory. There hasn't been a theory of everything. How does body problems connect to dreams? How do you use that in public work and what have you? So I've always been looking for a unifying field theory, not just in physics and not just in psychology, but something that will connect physics, psychology, and spiritual traditions, because spiritual traditions have always been trying to think up and imagine images of some unifying force, God, or with all its various names, some mind of God, that intelligence in the universe that moves us. So my research on the process mind is an attempt to pull these various fields together. The process mind really simply says, in a way, that as you and maybe others know, some others know, something moves us that we can't quite define yet. If you're really sensitive and open and just standing up, just the slightest, it's like a little breeze or a little something moves us. There's something intelligent that moves us. If you follow your movements and what have you, you find out its meanings. So my attempt to pull all these fields together and to find out what is this thing that moves us, I've been calling the process mind.
You could write about it, and maybe you can, but it's an experience, I think. If people, explaining it is one level, but making people aware that there is this thing that moves them, I think, is at the core of many spiritual traditions.
That's absolutely right. And that's why I say you should never, I won't, and I don't recommend anybody believing in anything unless you yourself can experience it. And that's why, for example, that Process Mind book there, I give many, many different exercises so that people can actually experience this thing moving them. The experience is more important than our understanding of it. Because it will explain itself to each in her own way in time.
So I mean, you are reflecting the greater movement in culture, I think, as well. I think many of us are coming to this place of embracing the mystery and not explaining it. And how do you see that manifesting in the world? I mean, I see a shift where I'm coming from. Do you see it in your work in the world with conflicts and people and, you know, psychology and all that? Is there something coming, or is it sort of a new age fantasy?
It depends upon the group of people that you're working with and that you deal with. If there is definitely in the psychologies an attempt to get deeper and to embrace this wisdom that is in the background and to follow it. There's no doubt about that because it has a healing effect. That's definitely there. Now in medicine, I think people are awake. I'm more optimistic about medicine than I was years ago. There's many indications that people are looking for the spirit of the human being as well as their material body. But the large mass of people, when you are starving and you are under terrific stress or you're terrified that you're going to be killed, there I don't ask people to necessarily have a spiritual experience unless it is something that they can, unless it's natural to them to have it. Some will have it even there, but the majority won't. And that's why I say what we need is more people who have the sense of this ancient reality. Today it's still a new reality, for the Western world especially, a new sense of being that incorporates all the various sides. We need more people like that in the world helping others. You can teach this best by modeling it.
I think people are waking up, and I think there are more people coming forward. I mean, I've interviewed Deepak Chopra many times, and he's out there and he's making an effort to bridge the worlds that many people couldn't. And I think there are more and more people listening to this kind of conversation.
Yes. So, yes, Deepak is right about that, and there are many, many people trying to do that. And but then again, I say, look at we need more people doing it, and I like the optimism that it's happening, but I still am waiting for it to happen politically. Mm-hmm. Even though I myself have worked with leading government people in different governments, when it comes to actually sitting down or deciding about going to war with another government, Alan, there is a problem, and the leaders have not been able to do it yet. So that doesn't mean they're not going to, but they first have to see it modeled at home. That's why I don't think the leaders are the world leaders themselves. I think the world leaders are the people in the grocery stores and the people on the subways and on the streets who can model more of what you're saying. More of us are picking up. I want to see it modeled more.
Yeah. But is there a collective body of humanity? It seems like there must be. We have these individual dream bodies and reality bodies, but there must be this great body of humanity. So if people are going to war somewhere, it's a reflection of what's going on in every part of the human dream body, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great point and a great question. There is a reflection going on. And And war, what we call war, namely people getting into conflict to the point where they're going to kill each other, I feel that that can be made unnecessary. In other words, I'd like to see that be made old-fashioned. But to do that, that means to really make that old-fashioned conflict. The world loves, the universe loves diversity. And diversity means we don't agree all the time. We have different viewpoints.
Well, diversity doesn't have to mean we don't agree. I mean, diversity could just mean different. We can honor our differences.
Exactly. Exactly. And getting people to honor those differences, that's the universe. That's what we need to bring more into the foreground.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. But if we could somehow see all of humanity as one body, which I
Yes, think, I do. Yes.
Right. So is there a way to talk to these political leaders in those terms where they can see it that way also?
Yes. And I'm doing it. We've done it. I can't name the countries that we're involved in. We're doing it. We've done it. And then while they're with us, they do it. And as soon as they're alone, after a couple of weeks, they're not able to maintain that kind of awareness yet. And that's why I say more of a mass movement needs to happen. I don't think we're going to see it politically before we see large mass movements of people able to open up diversity to see the other side and the other person as valuable. That would be an amazing and remarkable change. And I do think it'll come, but it takes some time.
Oh, well, how? We have a question here. I'll go ahead by Ron. Go ahead.
My wife and I have been involved with group work for many decades.
Great.
And our interest is in what we call the power of the unseen collective consciousness, of which mm-hmm. People generally are not aware. So I think what we come up against is what is generally called the ego. And we do not, I don't think we understand what the ego is. We can talk of it anatomically, we can talk of it behaviorally, but I think it's so essential to develop, perhaps the ego is part of our essential dream body. I don't know what you would call it, but how would you look at the ego? It is a great, very difficult task for people to be willing to look at the forces that are actually working through them. We so much identify ourselves with the negative aspects of these forces. We need a new attitude, perhaps something like what you're talking about, even in relationship to the negative forces that move through us.
Beautiful. Are you finished, Ron?
Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. I love your attitude, and I love your bringing the ego into the whole thing. You've got it right. The problem is that most people identify normally with their everyday reality and with their ego. I must do this. I must do that. I think this. I think that. And can't drop down to other experiences that are deep within them, that I think we all know about and all talk about. And I know that from our work around the world, that when that happens, I say, well, please have more ego. Do go ahead and let's hear more about your viewpoint, your one-sided viewpoint. And then I noticed that when I move into their position and I pick it up and I say, I am feeling this way. I'm going to make it easier for them because I pick up their role for them and speak for them. I say, my viewpoint is I want to get this other side. And the reason is I try to get deeper underneath ego. Then people seem to relax.
By reflecting their own process, they can witness it and release it. Is this?
Yes, by reflecting their process and by picking it up for them. One of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons people are so stuck in their damn one-sidedness is because nobody else will help them pick that side up and go deeper with it to show what it's trying to say.
Oh, so you for help them pick it up and go deeper with it, and so they can finally get to what it's trying to tell them.
You got it. I'll give you an example of that.
Yes.
For example, some years ago, before the revolution in South Africa, Amy and I were working in Cape Town, and we were working on conflict between the different tribes and between the white community there. Wow, that was hot. At one point, one person from one tribe said to, I won't name the tribes, said to another person in another tribe, if this conflict doesn't get settled, when we walk out the door, I'm going to kill you. And then some white woman came forward and said, oh, sweetie, you wouldn't want to do that, would you? And that attitude irritated that particular person so much, they said it again, I'm going to kill. And then I got into it. I said, yes, you don't realize it would to kill somebody also could be so relieving. Revenge is somehow, it doesn't solve everything, but it makes you feel at least a little better. You're getting back for a little something. And then the woman who had said she was going to be a killer started to cry. She said, yeah, that's right. It's been so painful. Really, I'm just hopeless. I don't want to murder the other person. That's an example of getting into a one-sided position that actually softened the person, help people to understand their one-sidedness. They're stuck there perhaps for a reason.
Well, they were heard. I mean, it's related to Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication in a way.
Beautiful.
Just being heard helped her shift that feeling, holding.
There you go.
Yeah.
Marshall, yes, Rosenberg is doing terrific stuff, absolutely.
Well, you're doing amazing stuff. I love your vitality, your enthusiasm for life, for learning, for experience. You just go right at it and you welcome it. It's really inspiring to hear you talk and to meet you and to see the person behind the words, to see you in your vitality, Arnie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
I just wanted to ask you one question before we wrap up. Is like what?
Sure.
I mean, it just came to me. What is the most outrageous thing you could think of or feel or have happened? What's the most outrageous thing that comes to you that really blows your mind, you know, that opens you up?
The most outrageous thing I can think of that opens me up and blows my mind is, again, something that happened with a large group of people in Oakland. We were working on during times of trials down there. And it was amazing. And there was a bunch of African Americans and a bunch of white Americans screaming at each other. And one single person, an African American, came forward during the Rodney King trials at that time. One single person came forward and he started to cry. Everyone was yelling at each other and he started to cry. And his crying touched groups on one side, then another. People felt his tears. That was the most outrageous, most magnificent thing in a large public situation where people wanted to kill each other. He came forwards with his tears and melted the whole group. There were hundreds of people. The San Francisco Chronicle gave us credit for that, but it wasn't us. It was this single person who helped that whole scene come together.
Because we all have this ability to feel the same thing. We are such amazing beings of feeling and emotion and sensitivity. If we would only recognize that parts of ourselves, the world could live in peace and harmony if we recognize how sensitive we are, right?
You got it. I love your attitude.
Well,
yes, yes.
I'm excited about this because I'm involved in the arts, and I think the arts are ways that we do feel more. But tell me what you were going to say.
I was going to say that the attitudes, we need to open up to one another. we shouldn't make war with war. We have to be careful not to be in conflict with one another, thinking others are lower consciousness or not. Those people who are able to develop the ability to facilitate, we want to encourage them, go deeper and bring your wisdoms out in art, bring it out in music, bring it in writing, bring it out on the streets, and please feel supported by us. We all need you to do that.
Thank you, Arnie. Very beautifully spoken. And your website is Arnold Mendel. Is that the website that people can find you?
Best website is www.aa, that's Arnie and Amy, two A's, A-A Mindell, MINDELL.net, aamindell.net.
Mm. I'd love to bring you to New York and do an evening there or a weekend. That would be possible, right?
Terrific, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll be in touch.
We'll be in touch.
You can call me anytime, and maybe I'll give you a little ring after the show here. But
is the show done now?
Almost. I'm just going to say goodbye. I mean, this.
Oh.
but thank you,
Alan. Thank you so much for your outrageous ability to bring forwards and to elicit the deepest part of me and of all of us. I've seen you do this with other people as well. Thank you so much for using your abilities in this way.
Well, you know, I'm just eternally curious. I am just, you know, especially people like you and the people I'm with here, creative thinkers and people who are not willing to go with what's been accepted. There are people willing to look outside the box of what's possible. That's what's so inspiring, and I want to share with whoever's listening. So
beautiful.
Thanks again.
Thank you, and a big hug to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Arnie, for your work.
And to you, Ron, and to the others there in your room as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, wonderful. It was wonderful listening to this. Very exciting. And I sent it all over Facebook.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yes. I've been talking here with Arnold Mendel, and his wife is Amy. There's there too. And his latest work, your latest book is called
Process Mind.
Process Mind, and he is the originator of an amazing body of knowledge on the dream body. And you can see his work is still happening around the world. So, again, thank you for being a guest on New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. And if you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net and check my website, newrealities.com. I'm going to end with this song called Song of the Soul.
I am not dying. I am dancing, dancing along in madness. There is no sadness, only a song of the soul.